Welcome to the Crypto Graduate Podcast by the Stanford Blockchain Club. I'm Julianne, a student at Stanford's Graduate School of Business.
And I'm Raman, an electrical engineering PhD student at Stanford. In this podcast, we hear the personal journeys of the builders, thinkers, and doers in crypto. We learn why they started in crypto and what they did to graduate from crypto student to crypto leader. Let's get started.
Welcome, everybody, and welcome, Nick. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here.
Nick Grossman is a general partner at Union Square Ventures, a venture capital fund based in New York and one of the earliest VC funds to start investing in crypto. And near and dear to our heart, Nick graduated from Stanford with a BA in urban studies. So, Nick, we're really excited to have you on the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah. And so just to get started, Nick, what we like to ask all our guests is if you could just walk us through your crypto journey, you know, like how did you get started? What got you most excited in it?
Yeah, sure. I love hearing these stories because everybody comes at crypto from a different angle. You know, some people come at it from the computing side. Some people come at it from the finance side. There are many other sides. So before joining USV, I joined VGSV in the beginning of 2012. So it's been about 10 years. I was at another company that was in the open source and open data space. And I had spent the last 7 years learning about building businesses and building businesses using an open source model and really pursuing getting open data standards promulgated out in the world. And a lot of my thinking during that time was about sort of the power dynamics in software systems and proprietary systems versus open systems and some of the challenges of getting open systems to market and, you know, some of the benefits of open systems, but also just like the complexity of a kind of a centralized technical system versus an open decentralized technical system is something I had been thinking about for a long time. But in a pre-crypto, pre-blockchain world, I joined USV in 2012. USV has been investing in Web2 style internet platforms since 2003. We were known for investing in things like Twitter and Etsy and Twilio and MongoDB, sort of a mix of consumer and infrastructure, internet platforms, scaled platforms, which was really, I think, exciting. Sometime around 2012 or 2013, we started paying attention to Bitcoin. The first big unlock was maybe this is not just sort of some sort of internet funny money, but maybe it's some kind of a computing protocol. And, you know, it's a peer-to-peer protocol. It's a way of producing state on the internet. So like persistent data used for, in this case, financial transactions. But I think that started a conversation among our team. And I think our team has a real appreciation for kind of the history of technology and, you know, how systems get layered over time. And we just kind of got curious about Bitcoin as a computing protocol. And we wrote a blog post, I think in 2013, called Bitcoin as Protocol, which was just some short musings on the idea that maybe there's something profound here. Maybe there's something here that looks like Internet 1.0, like TCP/IP and SMTP and these kind of foundational standards that like created the open, so-called open internet. That was a really exciting idea to us. And that kind of opened our eyes to it and got us interested. Right around that time, we had invested in the Series A of Coinbase as one way of being involved in the space and as a start. And then after that, our aperture kind of opened and we started meeting entrepreneurs who were fascinated by the same concepts. And I'll never forget the first meeting we had with Juan Bennett, who's the founder of Protocol Labs, the team behind Filecoin. We were the seed investors there. And I think it was 2014 that we invested. And this was pre-Ethereum, pre-token, whatever, but there were a lot of entrepreneurs, very technical entrepreneurs that were swirling around this idea of peer-to-peer compute and what can you do with it? And Juan put up a graph on the screen that showed the Bitcoin hash rate over time. He said, I want to do the same thing for storage. And we were like, wow, cool. So you can take this kind of economic idea and apply it to a different, completely different computing primitive. And then right around that same time, we had met Muneeb Ali and Ryan Shea, who were working on a project called OneName at the time, which is now became Blockstack and since has become Stacks. And they were saying, we think we can build identity, like an internet-based identity on this. And by the way, this was a long time ago, like before everything. And we're like, wow, cool, interesting, okay. And then we met another entrepreneur, Jesse Walden and Dennis Nazarov, who were building a project called MediaChain, which was an idea to put metadata for media objects in a kind of peer-to-peer blockchain style format, which was really a precursor to NFTs. right? But again, this was all before any of the infrastructure for that existed. But we started meeting these teams who were like really expanding on the idea of what could be built using this architecture. And that just seemed incredibly exciting. So we made a small number of very small investments back in that 2014, 2015 time period that kind of got us going down the rabbit hole. And we've since made a number of investments in things like Uniswap and Helium and Dapper Labs and a bunch of other protocols, you know, applying these ideas in different parts of the stack. And we're going to keep doing that. And we're also still investing in Web2, you know, platforms. We're not a crypto only fund. We've always seen this as kind of another part of the evolution of the building blocks of the internet, as exciting to us today as it was almost 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing. And then just because I'm a little curious about your personal background as well, I think Julianne said you had a BA in urban studies.
Yeah.
So I'm curious how, like, even before the open source firm that you worked at, how did you kind of jump from urban studies to maybe working in like open source, which I maybe attribute more to computing, but I can totally see how, you know, more holistic mindset likely helps you identify projects there as well.
It's a good question. We've always been interested in cities and how cities get designed and made. And at the same time, I've always been a technologist and a sort of hacker, tinkerer kind of person. I ended up studying urban studies in college kind of by accident and ended up working in that field for a while. I didn't go into college thinking I was going to study cities. I went into college thinking I was going to study engineering, for instance. And as I got kind of fascinated with how cities got designed and were evolved over time, I was coming at it from the perspective of a consumer. Like, what does it take to make a public space that feels great? And what are the mechanics behind it? Not just the politics, but the infrastructure, the processes, and so on. And I ended up working for several years out of college at an urban planning consulting firm, working with cities to develop plans for improving public spaces. And that a taste of the governance process, if you will, which, you know, at a local level, which is complicated and messy and confusing and democratic mostly. And so I think I've always been interested at this intersection of kind of design and governance and infrastructure, if that makes sense, for cities and also for technology. And the open source company that I was working at after that was actually applied open source in the urban data and transportation data space. So it was like this blending of my two interests. And then I think I quickly realized that there's a governance component to technical systems and computing systems. In the centralized world, that's Facebook and its shareholders. And in the open source world, it's this kind of messy mix of contributors and stakeholders. And then in the crypto world, it's an even broader, even messier mix of different forms of governance. And I think one way of looking at crypto is as a massive experiment in governance. And I think that's really exciting and has the potential to create platforms that feel more like public goods and less like shopping malls. And so that's been behind my interest, I think, the whole time.
That's really cool. I mean, like in my head, I'm just jumping to like all the things you talked about for public spaces that maybe make them scale or comfortable are likely true for public blockchains or maybe, you know, like an open source, like public project. So I would never have thought it, but it's actually really cool that you kind of happened to go along that path at Stanford.
Yeah. And it seems like a funny intersection, but I think it actually sort of makes sense. And I think a lot of the entrepreneurs in the Web3 space have a real public-minded spirit to them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of language about, you know, this idea of building public goods and creating quote-unquote credibly neutral infrastructure. There's this ethos of nobody looks sideways at like the TCP IP protocols because everybody just trusts them and use them universally. That's very different than how people think about companies like Facebook or Apple or Google that are, you know, companies and you're either inside or you're outside. And I think we're still really early in all this, but I think part of the potential of crypto and Web3 is to create additional layers of infrastructure that have more neutrality like the original internet protocols, but also have more functionality than was possible back then.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be too like Pollyanna-ish and like glossy-eyed about it because there's a lot of risk and danger and scams and problems as part of this too that everybody's working through. But I think the founding philosophy, I think, is one that's has a very public-minded spirit to it.
Yeah. I don't know if you follow some of like Balaji's work,
but
you know, he's always fascinating to like read his Twitter stuff about. And he just like released a book, Network States. And it's, I find it really cool because it's similar ideas where he, you know, one step beyond just thinking about them as protocols, but it's like, how do they fit together in this future city that, you know, you would maybe consider as a network state, and what makes it useful for that kind of purpose?
Yeah, not just I think his work is really worth reading because he takes it to another level about nation states and economies, you know, which is, I think, a pretty big leap for a lot of people to make. There's a lot of radical thinking there, but I think a lot of that ethos is also present in the original Bitcoin paper. And, you know, who knows like exactly where this will all land. I think there's a version of it that's like more efficient, more reliable, more trustworthy internet infrastructure. And then there's a version of it that's maybe some sort of more radical future. And the end will probably be some blending of them. But I agree with you. I think Balaji's writing is interesting, and he takes the kind of urban planning or like public nature of this to another level.
Awesome. Yeah, we spoke with Dan Benet, who's a professor at Stanford and runs, kind of started the Stanford blockchain community. And he says, you know, crypto and Web3 should be a political scientist's dream because it's such a great way to experiment. Absolutely. And it's people, right? So it's how we think about managing and governing people, to your point about governance. Well, cool. But maybe let's move into some of the meat of the discussion around crypto as kind of being the business model of Web3 or a new business model for the internet. We've tried to focus on different topics in the crypto and Web3 world on this podcast. And one thing we haven't touched on yet is how to think about it as a new economy or a new way for businesses to think about how they build value and spread value around their communities. So Nick, we know you've written a lot about this topic. Let's just start with, for our listeners, kind of the definition of tokens and what they are and why they matter with regard to Web3 business models.
Yeah, I think a token is a very flexible concept, and it's also very fundamental to understanding all this. But I think the simplest way to think about a token is a digital asset that can be owned and traded, and the ownership and transfer of ownership of that asset can be verified and trusted by the whole network. And asset is a intentionally flexible and broad term, because there are some tokens that may appear like to look like money or dollars, and there are some tokens that may appear to look like kind of more like stock or a sort of a commodity style asset. There are some tokens that may look like represent a single piece of art. A token really can be any type of asset, and that the fundamental property of them is that they can be owned and traded and verified. And once you have that as a bedrock concept, you can build really interesting and open things on them. You can attach value to them. And I think one of the ways I think about it is like, contrast a token to, I don't know, like something from the traditional world. Most people would not be too interested in building a robust economy on something like MX points, right? Like, you wouldn't borrow a million MX points to go buy a house, because even though MX points are assets, they don't have these other properties of verifiability and secure ownership. And also, they can be created willy-nilly by American Express. Nothing wrong with MX points. Like, I have plenty of them and I've used them, but I wouldn't put my net worth into MX points. And I think that the fundamental fabric of sort of blockchain tokens is that they are much more trustworthy because they're secured by a whole network and not by a single, you know, issuer. And the settlement of them, you know, can be verified. And once you have that, you can build real value on top of them in many, many, many directions. Really, in any direction that you could imagine assets in the real world, you can imagine assets that are secured by blockchains in the form of tokens. Yeah,
awesome. The Amex example is a really interesting one, because I think one question we get a lot from folks who are new to this space is like, well, there's not a lot I can do with these tokens or this cryptocurrency. Whereas, you know, an Amex point, you could go spend it largely in our economy. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about this idea of utility with tokens or currencies in crypto versus, you know, an investment or a way to kind of participate in these economies.
Right. And this is a really important question. I think a lot of people who start looking at the space for the first time, they think, well, what's the point of owning like a Bitcoin or something else if I can't use it in the existing economy? Like, when am I going to be able to buy potato chips with my Bitcoin? And I think just like there are many kinds of assets that serve many functions, there are many places where there's utility for crypto assets and many use cases. And so if you just look at the Ethereum ecosystem as one, There's been a lot of economic activity within the Ethereum ecosystem over the last 5 years. And it came kind of in phases. There was ETH itself, and that was really a speculative kind of boom. And then there was a bunch of people launching tokens on ETH, and those tokens really didn't have any economy attached to them. So that was really kind of a speculative boom. Then there was the development of these decentralized finance protocols where, you know, you could borrow, lend, trade. So utility, but still a very internalized economy, right? Mostly people who were already in it, trading and swapping with one another. So not really very many real world attachments. At that time, you could start to bring real money into that if you wanted to. And so there's a linkage between the real world and the crypto world. And it mostly came from like exchanges and so on. Mm-hmm. And then last year, you know, there was a big explosion of NFTs and more of a media marketplace built on Ethereum. So still like somewhat insular in that you've got a lot of people who maybe made money in crypto in the beginning, just trading with one another. But at the same time, you're starting to see more crossover and more connection to the real world. So things as kind of silly as celebrities purchasing high profile NFTs and making them their profile pictures, or the NBA using NFT infrastructure to sell highlights. That's actually a pretty big one. And we were involved in that, you know, the company behind that project is in our portfolio, Dapper Labs, and this project NBA Top Shot. And so I think there's going to be a continued set of bridging between the real world and the crypto world, where you get kind of a little bit of a snowball of economic activity internal, and then you start to build bridges out, and then that can kind of connect the economies. And I think that's going to happen slowly over time, but you're starting to see many more real world assets get attached to blockchain rails. You know, we have a project in our portfolio called Helium, which is a crypto powered wireless network where they're creating a bridge between wireless connectivity and blockchain tokens. You've got no shortage of projects that are in the process of issuing real world assets as tokens, whether that's sort of real estate interests, or probably the biggest one has been dollar stablecoins being issued on the blockchain. And there have been a lot of issues around how exactly to do that in a safe way. And, you know, and Terra blew up, as we know. But if you look at something like USDC, which has the most trusted, secured bridge between the real world and the blockchain world, that's really powerful, right? Because that's an on and off into tokens that enables connectivity. So I guess what I'm trying to say is the connectivity, I think, is going to continue to expand as more assets bridge in. And then another really important piece that I think we should touch on is there are real revenues and real business models embedded in a lot of these protocols. Mm-hmm. And so there's more than just sort of speculative activity on tokens. I think we're starting to see protocols that have revenue models that look more like businesses.
But just to echo off of that real quick too, like when you say real world and, you know, like blockchain world, I think there's a big like problem in like the physical real world versus the digital real world. Like as it stands today, like people are apprehensive about if digital stuff actually is physical stuff, right? Or if they would characterize the digital world as like the real world, right? And I think, you know, it's going to be a year or something before they get beyond that point, and it's slowly transitioning, right? Like I think even 5 years ago, people were like Facebook, you know, whatever, like, you know, and now it's like a huge company leveraging.
I think that's a really important point because crypto assets are digitally native assets. Mm-hmm. And so there is this sort of kind of offline world, online world thing that maybe I was just talking about. But then there's also this, a lot of life happens in the digital world and there are quote unquote real assets and real experiences and real sort of places that people inhabit in the digital world. And you're starting to see crypto assets show up in games, for instance. And, you know, I watch my daughter play Roblox, like that's a real place to her. Right. And, you know, you're going to have more and more experiences like that have, you know, crypto assets built into them, which is another way that they will become more real over time.
Awesome. That is a really interesting point in terms of it's not just to increase utility of the crypto ecosystem or tokens. It's not just more ways that people can use those tokens. So more use cases and applications. Mm-hmm. It's also an increase in connectivity to make sure it's connected to both the digital and the physical world that we think about today.
Yes. And I think those connections will come in so many forms. Like we keep talking about how a big unlock that hasn't quite happened yet, but is feels close is having native support for crypto assets in web browsers and phones, for instance. Like, that's another bridge where there will be one less hurdle to use this stuff and connect it with applications. There's a phone called the Nothing Phone that's launching tomorrow in the UK that's going to have wallets, you know, built in. And we're starting to see more adoption of browsers with wallets built in. And so that's like on the infrastructure side, I think the connectivity is still forming and will make a big difference in terms of utility.
I'm a huge like fan of Brave browser. And I feel like I've recommended to all my friends, and every single one of them that have switched over have never switched back to Chrome. So one day.
Yeah, and once you start using a web browser that has crypto in it, now you're in the world. Like, and you can do that by installing MetaMask or Phantom in any browser today. You know, that's still a leap, I think, for a lot of people. It feels inevitable that browsers like Brave and phones will have crypto wallets in them in the next some number of years. You know, there's already the secure enclave on the Apple and Google phones, which can perform that function. So I think that will be a major unlock. And there is sort of a, and this wasn't exactly the question, but there is sort of this magic moment when you show up somewhere that expects a wallet, you log in with your wallet, whether it's MetaMask or anything else, and all of your data, all of your assets, all of your transactions are there with you. So in the Web2 world, all of your data and all of your history lives in each application that you happen to visit. You know, my Facebook history is in Facebook, and my Google history is in Google, and my Twitter history is in Twitter. In the Web3 world, it lives in your wallet and it's attached to your on-chain identity, and that's really yours. And I think that's another sort of kind of utility that will emerge, which is the, you just show up with your wallet and everything just like works, and you are who you are on the internet. And it can be an application that you've never interacted with before, but you've still got your whole backpack on with all your stuff in it. That's just like a magical thing. And once that becomes more of the normal experience, I think there's going to be more demand to deliver that experience to people in more places.
Yeah, that's a great point. Spent a lot of time like helping new users in crypto get started. And I think for better or for worse, because it's so linked with like money or forms of money, we think about transactions just as any time we spend online, but it's really like any time you interact with the internet is a transaction. It's your full digital identity, not just like what you're buying. And I think that moment is a really cool one for folks to say like, oh, like this is just all my history on the internet that I own, rather than these siloed companies.
Yep, I agree. And I think that's gets back to this and the initial question about like, what are tokens? And is this all just about kind of money or not? And really, that's where I think NFTs are such a major unlock, because they can be used for anything. We have a portfolio company called Parallel Markets. They do KYC, know your customer checks, and they can issue that as a token. So I went through a KYC process on Parallel. They issue me an NFT into my wallet. That NFT doesn't reveal any private information about me. All it does is say, these guys checked my ID and I'm a real person, right? That's actually incredibly valuable. And that really has nothing to do with money per se. It's just information, and it's like portable personal information, and NFTs enable that. And I think you're going to see that kind of thing innovated on a million different ways in the next little while that will broaden the utility and broaden the story.
Yeah, that's a great example, because talk about something that increases cost and complexity in our financial system today. Like, every bank has to check who you are, that you are who you say you are. So having that increases so much cost and complexity for users. So cool. Well, we could go a lot of different ways with this. I want to make sure to come back to this question that we referenced earlier around kind of how we can think about enabling new business models and new revenue streams in Web3. So maybe the best way to tackle this question is, how does a company or an ecosystem in Web3 make money? And maybe how does that differ from companies that we think about in Web2?
Right. And this is a really great question. I think it gets to, well, innovation in business models and what's possible. And it also gets to the investing environment. And is it possible to build bottom-up valuation models for crypto assets and crypto ecosystems that are built on fundamentals as opposed to, you know, just built on speculation? So maybe break it down a little bit. I think there are many possibilities here, but a few patterns emerging, right? So protocols themselves have revenues. So if you look at something like Ethereum, every time Ethereum network processes a transaction, there's a fee associated with it. That fee can be thought of as the revenue of the network. And that fee is shared currently between the miners and the token holders. And so a portion of it is burned, sort of taken out of supply, almost like a stock buyback. And a portion of it is paid out like a tip to the miners. in 2021, the fee revenue for Ethereum was something like $10 billion. Let's just say for round numbers. That's a number you can look at, and that it's not a, you know, Ethereum is not a company, it's a network. So you have to think about it a little bit differently, but it has users who pay money to use a service, and that money goes to some service providers, you know, and it's a little bit like an Airbnb model where the stay fees get shared between the host and the platform. In protocols like ETH, the user fees get shared between the sort of suppliers, miners or validators, and the network itself. So that's very straightforward, actually, if you think about it. And I think we're going to see more and more networks that have that kind of economics built into them, different functional networks and multiple layers. There's another place to create a business model here, which is to be a supplier. So you can be a Bitcoin miner, you can be a validator on proof of stake network. In our portfolio company, Helium, which is the wireless network, you have people who are wireless miners. If you take a file storage network like Filecoin, you've got people who are providing storage. And so if you think of the sort of platform story as being like, you know, you're the Airbnb, you know, you can be the supplier on any of these platforms. And just like on platforms like eBay or Airbnb, you have some individual people operating. You also have like small, medium, and large size businesses that get built on those platforms. And so in every one of these ecosystems, there are small, medium, and large businesses that are protocol suppliers, you know, as a generic term. And that's really exciting. All these protocols are sort of marketplaces that way. And you can be a liquidity provider on Uniswap, or you can be a lender on Compound. There's protocol native business models that are as participants in the protocol, not as kind of owners of the protocol. And then, you know, just like any open source ecosystem or kind of software platform, there's opportunities to build businesses that intersect with the protocol or sit on top of the protocol. So if you think of something like Coinbase, they are a trading platform and a custodian, and they are not native participants in the really in the protocols that they interact with, but they are service providers on top, and they built a very large business there. Or if you look at something like OpenSea, as of the largest NFT marketplace, they're a business on top that provides liquidity, trust, discoverability, all these like marketplace functions, but they're not really a protocol participant quite the same way. And I think so Red Hat was like one of the original open source service provider businesses. I think there'll be businesses that look like Red Hat, businesses that look like Coinbase, OpenSea, and many, many, many others that are not really protocol participants, but really like layers on top. And I could go on and on and on, and you can go above and below. And I think there are businesses getting built, but I think the, you know, maybe the more interesting conversation is about protocol revenues and how do protocols innovate on doing that. There's also a whole nother ecosystem forming around DAOs. And, you know, DAOs as sort of human networks that are managing resources in the form of tokens or other kinds of capital. And I think there's another emerging set of business models there that, just if you're trying to make parallels, looks more like sort of investment funds or investment clubs or pools of capital or whatever. And I think there's an emerging set of business models there. And then maybe the last thing that we're starting to see, sort of membership business models built around NFTs. And you're seeing this within DAOs, you're seeing this within protocols. You know, an NFT as a very flexible asset can look something like a subscription or a membership or a SaaS fee or whatever, where if you're holding this token, you get access to some service. And that could be membership of a DAO, it could be showing up to events, it could be discounts on marketplace fees. And so this is more nascent, but also like really super duper interesting, where projects are starting to launch NFT sets that their users are buying, holding, trading. And what differentiates those from, you know, a traditional membership card or a SaaS subscription is that it's this tradable, flexible asset that presumably should develop a market price that reflects its utility. So that's a whole nother area. And I'm sure we'll see like 20 more business models that emerge in the next 5 years, but those are some of the ones that seem to be present today.
Awesome. There's so many different ways we could go with those different business models. I know one thing we talk about a lot is, especially within these new protocol business models coming up, I'd love to hear your perspective on how protocols and companies or marketplaces in this ecosystem can think about incentivizing their users in a way that kind of helps the user stay within that ecosystem. This is something we talk about a lot and see a lot happening. So maybe an example or interesting things you're seeing as it relates to incentivizing community members with these new protocols.
Yeah. And this is like an extremely powerful design space, one where we will see many successes and also many failures, where it's everybody knows that it's a powerful mechanic and there's a ton of experimentation going on and we're still very early in understanding how to best apply it. Just as that as a caveat, this is not a solved problem. It is like a powerful opportunity. You know, the original incentive mechanism for crypto networks was inflation of, you know, new assets. So if you were running a Bitcoin miner in the very early days, you just got some that were emitted every day. And the big difference being that it didn't cost anything for the network to buy these. So if Uber wanted to, and did, you know, wanted to incentivize every driver, every passenger, they have to do it with dollars because they're dealing with dollars and they have to go acquire those dollars from somewhere, investors or whatever. And that's really expensive and hard to do. Whereas in crypto networks, you have this kind of incredibly interesting opportunity to create an asset out of thin air that means something within your system. And if you get people to kind of come in and participate and help grow it, you know, there's the potential that that could maybe be valuable. And that was the sort of original incentive model. And I think that has really worked in some cases. And also it's how to do that in a way that is the most effective and the most sustainable is still an open question. So if you look at what happened with Terra, where they were paying 20% yield on deposits, but that was just coming out of an unsustainable place, you know, not out of revenues, but just out of, you know, out of treasury and so on and so forth, like that led to this big buildup, hype, and meltdown. And so for every example that sort of seems to work, there are also examples that have really not worked, back to my first point. It's all sort of variations on the same theme, which is giving away some asset to encourage early participation. In the DeFi space, especially in like the last 2 years, that was referred to as liquidity mining. So, you know, basically giving away tokens to not attract infrastructure, like, you know, people running nodes, but to attract capital. So if you park your capital here, we'll pay you a yield. I think every month and quarter and year, the models get sort of more sophisticated and more nuanced. And some of the failure modes maybe become more apparent. I was just reading this morning a little bit about, you know, what happened with SushiSwap, which was a competitor to Uniswap, which came out hot with a token and attracted a lot of liquidity and a lot of contributors. And one of the critiques of that approach and maybe why it hasn't sort of sustained is that maybe the incentives were too hot, too fast, and it attracted hot money that wasn't, you know, weren't the people who were going to stick around. So it's like, you kind of got to find this right balance of strong enough incentives that can help attract a community, but not so strong that it attracts just a mercenary community that's going to be moving on to the next hot money opportunity. And so we'll see this 1,000 different ways. I think, as I mentioned a minute ago, a new wave of this that's happening is around NFTs, NFT mints, and airdrops. And that's yet another kind of twist on this. And so, you know, I think it's a thing to watch. And I think it's an incredibly powerful mechanism. And the projects that get it right, you know, have the potential to grow very, very fast. And I think the biggest question really is how to tune it such that it's not just fast, but also sustainable.
Very cool. Before we move on to kind of our fun segment of questions, given all this kind of complexity and kind of the new experimentation going on in this market, how do you navigate it as an investor?
It's a good question. I think we try to be directional about it and believe in the long-term currents where things are heading and understand that we'll make mistakes and we'll get some things right and some things wrong. As an investor that's not a pure play crypto fund and has a sort of a broader mandate and thesis, rather than, you know, kind of try to be in everything or try to be in every trend or whatnot, the way we do it is try to identify the categories, the sort of broad areas that feel like they might be important. So wallets or games or developer tools, or pick your subcategory and have one or two investments that are along each of those themes with entrepreneurs that are thoughtful and credible. You know, there is a lot of risk in this space. There's regulatory risk, there's economic risk, there's technical risk. So we have to go in eyes wide open about all of those risks and try and build close relationships with really good teams. That's such a generic answer, but that's, I guess, how we think about it.
Yeah, that's super true. And I actually think about it even as me, like a personal investor. Like I'm a technical person. I'm doing like my electrical engineering PhD. And there's so many times that I get so like technically invested in a project because mm-hmm. I think it's so cool. And then I like push come to shove, like I should have maybe divested from it earlier than I did. And I saw the signs, but I was just so like, I was like, this is such a cool thing. So I bet you it's probably that on steroids when you're like doing it in a
well, it's also, it's a very emotional space. I think there's a tribalism and almost like a religious fervor to some of these projects that in some ways part of the magic, but also is part of the, you know, potential failure modes. Maybe there's a lot of things to look out for, but I think there's also, you know, I think a lot of idealism as much as there is a lot of opportunism. And so, you know, those are almost opposite risks. Like you don't want to end up in a mercenary opportunistic scenario, but you also don't want to end up in a, you know, an idealistic vision that doesn't have what it takes to like get traction and get momentum and get distribution and, you know, find success. So there's so many interesting nuances to this.
And I think slowly people are going to build on it. Cause like you said, like the token incentives, you know, if I had a token, I can pay people in tokens, even though I theoretically make these magic tokens out of thin air. And like in the real economy, like if you were to do that with stocks or something, like someone audits these things, someone looks at them, and in, you know, Web3, it's like a Discord and you go and you try to figure out if people are doing it responsibly or not. And eventually, you know, hopefully there's going to be like a lot of work there, you know, make things more transparent.
And I think that's an important thing to point out, which is that this is still a very nascent space with a lot of things that can go wrong. You know, like technologies can break. Yeah. Smart contracts have bugs. Just like there are scammers trying to steal stuff from people in the non-crypto world, there are a lot of scammers trying to steal stuff from people in the crypto world. So there's one of the areas of innovation and sort of diligent development that's needed is around safety, broadly speaking, such that people can feel comfortable interacting with this space and not have to feel like they're private detectives to make sure that everything that they're doing is safe, or that they're like security experts to make sure that their OPSEC is perfect so that they don't get their private keys taken.
Yeah. It's such a dilemma though, right? Like the decentralized purists, they love the fact that you have, with great power comes great responsibility. But then, you know, for like retail consumers, like it's probably not the best idea for every single protocol to be that way or something like that. So.
Right. And I think there's also a lot of innovation in trying to strike a balance between kind of sovereignty, you know, the idea that you really are in control, and safety.
Yeah.
Those are a little bit at odds, but there are plenty of teams working on new approaches to kind of solving that problem.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, okay. So now pivoting into kind of like the end fun segment for the last like 5 or 6 minutes. So the first one, we call it a bear talk. And this is probably one of the first episodes we're recording in a true, you know, I don't know if it's a bear market, but crypto has been down. Now it's back up, but whatever, it swings. Mm-hmm. So the first question we like to ask in the bear talk segment is, more often than not, you know, like when I'm on the street trying to pitch crypto to people, one of the big rebuttals I get is, you know, it's not very kind to the environment, or it has several ESG issues. And I think specifically people, you know, share this in the context of Bitcoin or proof of work algorithms. And I'm just curious, Nick, when people come to you with these types of arguments, you know, what are your common rebuttals, or how do you approach talking to them about it?
Yeah, this is a really important question. It's one that comes up all the time. And I think about it a few different ways. So crypto is a consumer of energy, period, right? Bitcoin and ETH in particular, because of proof of work. And if it never becomes broadly useful financial and computing infrastructure, then that consumption of energy will be pointless. And if it does become fundamentally useful as computing and financial infrastructure, which many of us in the space believe that it will, then I think you can have more of an honest or an informed kind of conversation about trade-offs. And we have this thing that now is useful and everybody agrees is kind of great. And, you know, what is the right cost to pay for that? Just like we have a conversation about trade-offs for commerce and banking and every other transportation, every other function in society has similar trade-offs. I think we're still really early in the value side of that curve or that conversation, you know, generally speaking. There's another piece of it, which is proof of work is a consumer of electricity and energy, but in a kind of an interesting way, because the market for digital assets and compute is a global 24/7, 365 market that's always available if you have an internet connection. There is a subset of use cases that I'm really drawn to where proof of work mining can be used to subsidize the development of renewable infrastructure. So I've met many entrepreneurs who are working on building out solar and wind and so on, who understand that there's not always a market right away for those assets, or they may be deployed in places where they're not grid interconnected or not going to be grid interconnected for a while, and on and on and on. And I think there's a growing consensus among a lot of renewable developers that mining and this kind of flexible compute is a really useful addition to their infrastructure, where I'm either selling my renewable energy, you know, to the grid or to an off-taker or to the Bitcoin network. And the Bitcoin network will always be there 24/7, 365, you know, at a certain price. I think a small one, but I think just interesting that that exists. And yeah. I think the last point on this is there is a separate set of blockchain systems that don't have the same energy footprint, proof of stake systems, where you use economic security, not energy security, to secure the network. You know, I think the biggest development on that is that Ethereum intends to transition from proof of work to proof of stake. It sounds like that may happen as soon as in September with the so-called merge to ETH2. I think that's really interesting. In a lot of ways, Ethereum is the ecosystem with the most vibrant experimentation and the most crossover between the crypto world and the real world. So if you just think about NFTs and like artists, musicians, like sort of cultural applications of Web3, most of that is happening on Ethereum. And a lot of the pushback to people participating has been on environmental grounds, where you have communities like rejecting cultural NFT projects that could be very interesting and beneficial to artists and creators, but that are seen in a bad light because of the energy footprint, which I understand. So I think the Ethereum in particular switching away to proof of stake is a pretty big moment for this conversation.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and I love the energy grid. And I just wanted to shout out that you have a good piece on this. I think it's Bitcoin as a battery, or Bitcoin as battery.
Yeah, and I received a fair amount of pushback on that exact terminology, because of course it isn't a battery, but I guess an actual battery.
Yeah.
The idea that it is this flexible load that kind of virtualizes energy production.
And all you need is internet, right? Like,
because exactly.
I think for many places of the world, they have renewables, but it's like the infrastructure to build the cables to bring it out there and then send it back to the grid is like infeasible.
Yeah. And even just to provide sort of additional incremental economics to those developers feels interesting to me.
Yeah. And there was another write-up actually that they talk about how renewables are actually, you know, like on a dollar basis, like the cheapest form of energy. And a lot of the reason why more people don't, you know, more places don't use it is just because, you know, accessibility is like hard. Like it's hard to find wind, find locations with sustainable amounts of solar, for example.
Right. And you could move, you know, this sort of enables compute to go to those places and finance that, you know, energy production and so on. Now, this can also work in the other direction, and you could have put a Bitcoin mine on a coal power plant or a gas well that could extend its life, you know, beyond the energy transition. And that would be moving in the exact opposite direction. So I want to be clear that that's also
cautious.
Possible.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And then Julia, maybe we can pivot into the this or that questions.
Perfect.
Like 5-ish minutes left. Yeah.
Great. Okay. So just some rapid fire questions for you, Nick. Are you a morning person or a night owl?
Neither. I'm sort of a get up late, go to bed early kind of person, but probably more of a night owl, although I do enjoy my occasional early mornings.
You're a sleep person, it sounds like. As am I. And DAOs or companies?
Both. I know that's a bad answer, but they're going to coexist and must, I think.
Love it. Still or sparkling water?
Sparkling, always.
Smart contracts or smart people?
Oh man, this is such a great one. I'm going to also go with both, but I think it's worth pointing out like how valuable a smart contract can be. We didn't really talk about it actually, but in the meltdown in the crypto credit markets for the past 2 months, all of the TradFi crypto lenders blew up because they made unsecured loans, you know, based on trust. And the sort of DeFi smart contract over-collateralized lending protocols did not break because that level of discretion wasn't built in. And so, you know, you could look at what happened in the last 2 months and think of that as bearish on crypto or as incredibly bullish on DeFi as reliable infrastructure. And that's how I see it. So I love smart people, and I spend all my day working with smart people or trying to work with smart people. but I'm going to do a plug for smart contracts on this one.
Love it. Bored Apes or CryptoPunks?
CryptoPunks.
Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Ethereum.
New York or Miami?
I'm a born and bred New Yorker, so I got to go with New York on that. But Miami's pretty cool.
Awesome.
You know, most of the New Yorkers have grandparents that have spent some time in Miami, you know, so we're familiar with both.
Yeah. Well, you only answered both to two, so I think that's a win for us.
Yeah. I'm sad you didn't put like any West Coast cities out there.
I went to Stanford. I lived in Aptos, south of Santa Cruz.
Nice.
After college, I love the coast of California in particular. But I think I'm a New Yorker at heart. I live in Boston now, so I'm it is what it is. But it's hard to shake New York.
Yeah. And then so two more questions. So one, what is the last book you read, or maybe a book you're currently reading?
I'm currently reading Daisy Jones and the Six, and I forget the author. My wife recommended it to me, and it's quite good.
All right. And then the very last question is, what is one thing you do every day without fail?
Man, what a good question. That's a stumper. And there's so many boring answers, like look at CoinGecko and like redo email. You know, first thing I do when I get up is I look at my Oura Ring and to see how I slept, back to me being a sleep person. Yeah. But I can't say I do that every day, but almost every day, that's the first thing I do.
That's a good answer.
That's a new answer.
You're health conscious. Yeah, it's a new one. We haven't had that one. Yeah. And it's okay. We have, I mean, like some of the most boring ones are probably the best ones. You know, the people that just get up and have a glass of water every single morning. And I'm sure after listening Jack Dorsey do that, there's probably a million people that do that as well.
The honest answer of what do I do every day is I drink 5 cups of coffee every day. I'm a massive coffee person, and I can't live without coffee. And without that is the only thing. I'm not like a creature of habit when it comes to good habits, but coffee is forever.
Do you have like a timing breakdown, or is it just 5 cups spread across?
Not even five. I wake up, I get a cup of coffee, and I just drink coffee all the way through until lunch. And then once I have lunch, I stop drinking coffee. But it's whatever I get up until lunchtime is coffee time.
Nice.
I love that. Well, Nick, thank you so much for your time today. This was a blast. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thank you. This has been really fun.
The views expressed by guests and hosts on their podcast are their own and not reflective of their organization or affiliates. And please keep in mind, the podcast guests and hosts are not providing investment advice. Thanks.
Thank you for making it to the end of the episode brought to you by Stanford's Blockchain Club. If you enjoyed the content, please do give us a follow. We look forward to bringing more interviews from great speakers in the coming weeks.